that first wave of the virus that hit caused more long haul than subsequent variants such as Omicron and Delta and things like that. As the acute disease seems to have wound down and got less deadly, the propensity of it causing long haul has also diminished, although it has not gone away. It can still get long haul from getting COVID today. But in that original wave, and my wife was one of those people, she got acute COVID in, I believe, toward the end of March or early April 2020. And we were in Connecticut at the time. And that was when the hospitals were melting down.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Amy Myers with the Take Back Your Health podcast. Today's guest is Dr. David Brady, who has over 30 years of experience as an integrative medicine practitioner and 25 years in health science academia. He's a licensed naturopath medical physician in Connecticut and Vermont and is board certified in functional medicine and clinical nutrition and a fellow of the American College of Nutrition. He's the chief medical officer of Diagnostic Solutions Labs and Designs for Health. He is in private practice in the integrative medicine group Whole Body Medicine in Fairfield, Connecticut. He's the former long-term vice president of the Division of Health Sciences and director of Human Nutrition Institute at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. He is also the author of FibroFix, which was published by Rodale. You can learn more about Dr. David Brady at drdavidbrady.com, as well as fibrofix.com. So excited to have you here today. Welcome, Dr. Brady. Before we get into this week's interview, just a quick reminder that we've created a special offer specifically for listeners of this show on your very first purchase of any of my products on amymyersmd.com. Simply enter promo code TAKEBACK15 at checkout and you'll receive a 15% discount on your first AMMD purchase. That's promo code TAKEBACK15 at amymyersmd.com. Welcome to Take Back Your Health. Our next guest is Dr. David Brady, a longtime dear old friend that I've known, my God, I don't know how many years now, 10, 15, something like that.
At least that.
At least that.
More than that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we go way back at IFM. So I know you well, but why don't you just tell our guests a little bit about yourself before we dive into some questions?
Ah, quick story. I'm a Jersey guy.
Really? I couldn't tell
when
by
I
accent.
Grew up, yeah, and I was a rock and roll musician and touring, played all music stuff before I decided to get serious and go back to school. Then I got an engineering degree and I worked in aerospace, but then I started working in kind of biomedical stuff. And that's what got me into being interested in medicine and clinical stuff. And so anyway, for the last 32 years or something like that, been integrative and functional medicine. And I spent a lot of that time at various universities, mostly at the University of Bridgeport, more in academic medicine and academic training, and various roles, professor, dean, and then vice president of the University for Health Science. So it was sciences. So I really oversaw a lot of different disciplines in health sciences and the whole public clinic system. So that was really interesting, and it was really one of the few places in a true academic setting where we were really delivering functional and integrative medicine in our public clinic system and training people how to do that. So that was really cool. And at the same time, I've always been in clinical practice in integrative medicine, functional medicine, clinical nutrition, and involved in industry. Been the chief medical officer of one of the leading professional nutritional supplement brands, Designs for Health, for over 20 years, and designed the lion's share of their products, and was also always in the diagnostic or functional medicine space with a lot of the different labs that have been around. And then we actually started Diagnostic Solutions Lab, or DSL, about 7 years ago, and it's become one of the leading omics labs in functional and integrated medicines. All of that keeps me busy, and they all kind of connect and synergize, and it's a lot of fun.
They do. And I always talk about how there are those of us that were in clinical practice and sort of went the route that I did with the books and the podcast and all this stuff. And then the true brains behind functional medicine was this other core group. And you certainly are one of those that I would often early on in my career and my practice rely on. And ask advice of, and certainly always love catching up with at conferences. So
I did the book thing and all too, just not as good as you.
No. But there's definitely that core group when we used to have the journal club that I would just absorb from you guys. So happy to have you here and super excited to be talking about a really hot topic and a critical topic, which is long haul syndrome. And so I'm excited that this is an area that you've gotten into and really excited to learn from you. And I know our listeners are as well. So why don't we just start off with kind of a working definition of what is long haul syndrome?
Well, in a nutshell, without getting too technical, it's really people who had acute COVID in its normal clinical form that people think of with the upper respiratory infection. And they may have had it at different levels of severity. But when they recovered from what you would call the acute illness, and most people just go on to a full recovery, especially at this point, many people don't. And they have lingering, ongoing, sticky symptoms that stay around and just don't go away. And they're usually a subset of the symptoms that are also seen in acute COVID, for the most part, not 100%. But generally, people have COVID, and then they go on to have just a persistent level of fatigue, brain fog, lack of exercise or exertional tolerance. So if they try to go out and do things that they were always able to do without much of a problem, they just can't, they either can't do it, or if they force themselves to do it, they're just trashed. Muscle pain, fatigue for days. A lot of pain, really strange, difficult to typify pain, a lot of pain around the rib cage. It almost feels like a chest wall syndrome or a rib out of place kind of thing, but there's really nothing that we can identify structurally or anatomically wrong, but they certainly have pain there. And a lot of what is often kind of collected under the umbrella of POTS. So a lot of tachycardia or rapid heartbeat, particularly episodically, like it comes out of nowhere. It's not just when they're exerting themselves. All of a sudden, they'll have tachycardia. It tends to be more in the evening. And they'll get Raynaud's phenomena, like very cold episodic extremities, hands and feet, ice cold, even if there's really no reason for it. And they're in a warm ambient environment, dizziness when they stand up. So like a postural hypotension. So that can really affect a lot of people. And then there's a whole myriad of other symptoms that can also be at play that are less prevalent, but are common, like persistent loss of taste or smell or neuropathies, kind of weird neurological phenomena and things like that.
And are you seeing people with any neurologic symptoms besides neuropathy or the brain fog?
Neurological symptoms, okay, like a neurologist would pick up on an examination, right? So it's not like overt loss of sensation. There's no motor deficit. There's no like upper motor neuron sign. No like crazy neurological symptoms, but definitely functional inattentiveness, memory issues, can't multitask, can't hold a thought kind of things. And then the neuropathies tend to be kind of fuzzy around the edges as well. Like if you do nerve conduction velocities and all these different objective tests, they don't really pop a lot on that. The patient at least perceives these weird neurological sensations. And it's not always the like the typical like numbness or anything like that. It's often like a feeling of buzzing or like a paresthesia kind of feeling that really comes and goes. And it's not really typified in a frank dermatological pattern. It's really not straight down the line kind of stuff. That's what makes it hard.
What are you seeing as the mechanism for long hauls?
Well, that's a very debatable thing. And there is no sort of a unified, agreed upon etiology for what's causing all these symptoms. But it's certainly not new with COVID. This is classic. It's a more dramatic example of it, but it's classic post-viral syndrome type of presentation. Now, we've seen this before, even with SARS-1. A significant amount of people, particularly the healthcare providers, cared for people with SARS-CoV-1, which did not infect as many people, luckily. But it over 50% of the healthcare workers that cared for those patients ended up with what we would now call long haul syndrome. It was just sort of a post-exposure chronic fatigue syndrome. But really, for what we've called for years, decades, chronic fatigue syndrome and ME, or even in most cases, classic fibromyalgia syndrome. Chronic EBV is another example. These are all post-viral syndromes, and they share a lot of the same kind of symptoms, particularly the fatigue, the muscle ache, the brain fog, the post-exertional pain, the post-exertional fatigue, and just the exercise intolerance. And some of the metabolic things we see when we test these people are the same or conserved between all of those post-virus syndromes. So this is not new. It's just sort of a new variation of what we've seen for a long time, but that the medical community and certainly the general public has never really fully appreciated this fairly common sequela to getting a viral infection, that the acute part of it, you survive it, but you go on to sort of a long-term dysfunction with a lot of symptoms that just never quite clear.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. I mean, you wrote the book FibroFix, and when I was going through medical school, really chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, they were very shunned. I mean, I was trained as an ER doctor, and I just remember when patients coming in with those complaints, I think I had more empathy than the average person because I was interested in holistic medicine, but I didn't know the root causes like I do now. And so I sort of would get, I think most got panicked because they didn't believe them. I would get panicked because, of course, I wanted to help them, but had nothing to help them. So I find it really interesting that with COVID, they very clearly, pretty early on, named this syndrome, right? Long hauls. Whereas for years, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and even Epstein-Barr and all of these other viral syndromes really have been, until what, maybe the last 10, 15 years, been virtually unrecognized by the conventional medical community. So, I mean, why do you think that this is being recognized? Is it just so abundant and it was so in their face they couldn't?
Yeah, well, a couple of reasons. They're very good questions. There's a couple of questions in there. They're very good questions. You're right. I mean, if we go back, I've been practicing 30 years, right? And before I trained in medicine, I trained in chiropractic. So I trained in like neuromusculoskeletal stuff. So fibromyalgia was really on the radar, right? But even in that training, it was sort of a bit dismissed, right? And then in conventional medicine training, it was certainly dismissed. And to me, that's just human ego arrogance, because it's, oh, if we don't understand it, or we don't have a test that can objectify it and definitively diagnose it, and we have nothing to offer the patients, then it can't be real, right? Like, it must be they're all making it up. Well, what's the odds of all of those people making this story up for some secondary gain or something? And all having the same exact story, right, is very consistent. So I never bought the fact that it's all in their head or they're all making it up. And I read about that in my book, The FibroFix. And in many ways, ironically, it is all in their head, but not in the way they meant. It's all in the head because it's all in the central nervous system and the way we perceive pain and the way we get locked in these strange sort of hypervigilance, PTSD almost type of patterns. But I was like you. I was in that latter type of doctor that I was like, I got to figure this out because, I mean, this is real. These people are suffering. I feel helpless because I can't really help them in the way I should be able to. And it's one of the things that pushed me into functional medicine, honestly, and lifestyle medicine and all this other things, because I realized there was no magic bullet. There was no drug that was just going to make them all better. It was a much more complicated thing. And no one really spent any time researching it for the most part, because there was really no money in it. There was no funding in it, right?
Because there was no drug to fix it.
Yeah. And it was just too complicated. There were too many variables going on, you know, too many symptoms, too many things. It was a very hard thing to research and try to come up with one druggable target, right? And that's when they fund things. But it's gotten so big, Amy. They can't ignore it. You know, if there's millions, tens of the hundreds of millions of people worldwide suffering from COVID long haul, or PASC, as the medical establishment calls it, and it's affecting national economies, it's affecting countries' ability to field a viable army and armed forces, it's causing massive drain on economies. And the biggest reason, unfortunately, this has to be the biggest reason, but usually is what moves the dial. There's a lot of money in curing it now because there's just so many people that there is a lot of research dollars going into it. And pharma doesn't have to fund it. It's basically being funded by governments, basically giving the money to academic centers and then translating it onto potential pharma agents. So if they do find it or they find anything effective, it's almost like going to be a free drug development for them. So there's a lot of reasons why I'm actually hopeful that some therapeutic agent that really consistently moves the dial on this will be found. And honestly, I don't care if it's synthetic. I don't care if it's natural. I don't care if it's a rain dance in the parking lot. I don't care if it's cobra venom or some drug. I just want it because too many people, their lives are wrecked over this and they're just not the same people they were. And they're aging more rapidly. You can see it. You can see it clinically and you can see it when you test them in various ways. So I'm hoping that all this research does yield something, but it's going to be hard because it's like I alluded to before. I don't think you're going to find one agent mm-hmm. that's going to hit one target, one receptor, one enzyme, or do one thing to a cytokine population or a white blood cell population to change cytokines that's going to universally make it all better. It's more complicated than that. It's such a systems biology ball of dysfunction is probably going to take coming at it from multiple angles, which is what we do in functional medicine.
Right. No, I definitely look forward to talking to you about what's on the horizon in terms of drugs and what to do before we get there, because I was mentioning before we started that I thought I might get long haul. It was my biggest fear with COVID. And then I did have some pretty significant fatigue for a couple of weeks afterwards, but I'll go through what I did and then compare it with what you're doing. So before we get there, though, have you seen, any predisposing factors to getting long haul? Is it more common in vaccinated or unvaccinated? Does it depend on, obviously, your metabolic health and other risk factors? Do you mind walking us through what you're seeing?
Yeah, another very interesting question and interesting observations. If you remember back to when COVID first really hit the U.S. in the spring of 2020, it became very apparent, even before it got to the U.S., right? First in Asia and then in Europe, that people who did the worst when they were exposed to SARS-CoV-2 and got clinical COVID and went into, ICU and early to vent and death in many cases because they were treating it wrong. They were treating it like a typical viral pneumonia, and it wasn't that. But the people who did the worst seemed to be people with comorbidities, right? They were obese or they had metabolic syndrome or COPD or diabetes or other kind of problems. But in total inverse of that, the people who got long haul were skewed toward people who were exceedingly healthy and metabolically fit. And the worst wave of long haul was definitely in the original viral wave. So that wild type virus that got, may not be able to say wild type because there's a lot of potential reasons on why that virus was around to begin with. But leaving that aside, that first wave of the virus that hit caused more long haul than subsequent variants such as Omicron and Delta and things like that. As the acute disease seems to have wound down and got less deadly, the propensity of it causing long haul has also diminished, although it has not gone away. You can still get long haul from getting COVID today. But in that original wave, and my wife was one of those people, she got acute COVID in, I believe, toward the end of March or early April 2020.
Oh, wow.
And we were in Connecticut at the time. And that was when the hospitals were melting down. Like there was ice cooler trailers around them with bodies and no doctor's offices were open. And the only thing open was the hospital. And so she started getting acute signs of COVID and she started getting worse and worse, couldn't breathe, had really bad dyspnea. So I literally had to take my truck to my practice, to our group practice, and I brought home oxygen units. I brought home hemolumen devices. I brought home pass-through blood ozone setups. We were doing nebulizing glutathione and liquid monolaurin, treating the lungs. We were throwing just about everything that we could at it, and all the nutraceuticals, all of the off-label drugs, things like that, IVs, and we kept her out of the emergency room in ICU, luckily. But she went on to develop long-haul COVID, and she was a professional dancer. She was a Broadway dancer, rock hit level dancer, extremely fit, extremely, I couldn't keep up with her, just metabolically crazy, energetic, and came from a long family, very high-level athletes, Division I college athletes, and state champions in wrestling, all these. So she had that kind of ability. And a lot of the people who got long haul COVID, a lot of marathon runners, a lot of professional athletes, a lot of people who were very fit. And when you think about it, or when we think back now, the reason certain people become really good athletes can do things better than other people, especially exertional things and athletic things, are usually that they have more of an ability to take in oxygen, get it into the blood, and then offload it into the tissues. So they perfuse the tissues with oxygen. They stay in aerobic metabolism longer before they go into anaerobic metabolism. They don't develop those waste products as quickly like lactate, and they can get more energy out of the same input. So same food substrate coming in, same oxygen coming in, they produce more energy. They could do things longer before they fatigue. So they're great athletes. And the reason that happens is they have usually denser vascular beds. They have more vascularity, especially in the very small blood vessel networks. They have better, and they don't have as much endothelial dysfunction, and they are very efficient at perfusing tissues. So they carry oxygen well, they onboard it well, and their tissues just are on rocket fuel compared to most people. That worked against them with long haul, because SARS-CoV-2 used the vascular system and the vascular networks that went in through these ACE2 receptors. They have a higher density of ACE2 receptors. So what worked for these people from an athletic and a perfusion standpoint may have worked against them with being exposed to COVID and driving this, not only keeping it in the lungs, but driving it into all these other tissues where it created these body-wide persistent or sticky symptoms. So really interesting.
Well, she's lucky that she had you. If she hadn't had you, right? I mean, think of all those people who didn't have a you and didn't know about functional medicine. I mean, I think, I don't know if you were on those. I was on some email chains early on with many people in functional medicine criticizing the vents before we really knew much about it and suggesting hyperbarics instead. And it's many of the things in those emails really have turned out to be true.
Yeah, I think we did the first sort of webinar kind of out to our colleagues in the whole COVID experience. It was me and our good common friend, Todd Lapine, and Peter Diadamo and some other people. We just put one together and we were talking about a lot of these things and some of those concepts that later came out in the frontline physicians groups and treating this stuff. And these were actually more conventional docs that were just on the front lines in the ICUs, and they were seeing what worked versus what they were told to do. And they were, it for nothing, the same thing. So they actually just started putting YouTubes up and formed this group and were daring to talk about how these things actually performed with real patients. And that's where the whole controversy started really burning with things like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine and others. So, and then they became political and unfortunate, but yeah, it was a crazy time. I was getting phone calls from people from physicians, ER physicians, ICU, critical care physicians in major New York hospitals. I never thought I'd get calls from them on things like, how do you do blood ozone? How do you do hemolome? And what is this? How do you do like IV nutrients? How do you, what about this herb? I mean, they were actually reaching out. I don't even know how they got my name and number, but just kind of interesting stuff. And of course, it all swung back the other way. We were hoping that it would be this paradigm shifting event would really bring it all together, and that didn't last.
No, it's been even more polarizing. Really, it's a shame. How's your wife doing now?
She's up and down, honestly. And like you said, she's lucky to have me. Well, I guess to some degree, she always says, well, good thing, nothing against plumbers, but she always says, good thing I didn't marry a plumber, you know what I mean? But it's been frustrating for me because I spent my whole career trying to figure out how to really move the dial and help people with chronic complex disorders. And that's what we do mainly in functional integrative medicine. That's where we shine most, I think, is with these people who kind of been left with no answers in conventional medicine. And they need someone to really dig deep and kind of do a lot of metabolic investigational, like detective work to figure out what's really wrong. And we've done that, and I've learned a lot through this process, and I learned a lot from colleagues. I'm plugged into all the researchers, plugged into the clinicians, I'm plugged into the people developing therapeutics and diagnostics in the field. So we know a lot to get these people much better, to make them functionally better, their symptoms less. But I honestly, there's no universal cure or agent at this point for any of these post-viral syndromes. They remain very elusive. So my wife's a lot better and I get her a lot better and then she'll flare, particularly if she's exposed to any new viral load or pathogen load. And it doesn't just have to be COVID. Even being exposed to somebody like in December, that kind of head cold thing that was going around the whole East Coast, at least. And then it finally Florida. And I never get sick. I'm around sick patients all the time. I got it somehow. And I was like, oh, no, hope she was in a good place. And I hope she doesn't flare. And she held on for about a week, but then she flared. Oh. So, and it's been pulling her back from that. So they're much more fragile metabolically and they're susceptible to going into this, switching into this immune hyper activity, like immune dysregulated state, which then drives really deep tissue inflammation and pain and mitochondrial dysfunction and a lot of brain fog and other things. So I guess she's doing better overall. She's certainly better than she was a couple of years ago, but it's not a linear path. And that's the same with all these long haulers, which makes it very frustrating for them because it's sort of a sine wave, like autoimmune disease, right? It goes up and down, kind of waxes and wanes.
I mean, I found COVID itself to be like that. That was kind of the most interesting thing to me when I had COVID was the first day I went and got to my IVs and I was like, ah, this is nothing. And then it was, you know, a couple of days later and then I really never got sick, but the fatigue lingered for me. Has she done any hyperbarics on a very regular schedule, so to speak?
Well, we did a lot of hyperbaric. We have real deal, like divers level metal glass, real deal hyperbaric units in our group practice in Connecticut. And we use those even when she had acute COVID, what I think is part of what brought her back and got her over the dyspnea and allowed her to keep perfusing tissues. So we used it a lot then. We were using it in long haul combined with a lot of other things. But then when we sort of relocated half the year to Florida, I don't have the same access to the same level of hyperbaric treatment. So I wish I did. And I wish I was able to do more of that. We do some of it when we can get to it and access it. But we've been doing so many things the whole time. One of the other frustrating things is sometimes when she gets better and we get good results, I'm never quite positive
what it is.
Did it because we're like, we're throwing everything in the can and barrel and shooting it, right? Because we're just desperate for her to get better. So that's one of the problems is trying to figure out all of these different variables, what's really moving the dial. And she just wants to be better and they all want to be better. So they're not in a clinical trial mono agent kind of thing.
Right.
So it can be a little bit difficult to determine sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have long haul. I just had fatigue. I mean, fatigue that I had before I found functional medicine that I think was from Epstein-Barr. I mean, I remember being at one gate in a busy airport. It was like Atlanta or something. And I was at B and I needed to be at A. And I just remember sort of dropping my bags thinking like, I just walked to B. I can't possibly walk to A now.
Right.
And it wasn't that extreme, but we have a one-story house. It's very spread out. And it literally was like, oh, I forgot this in the other room. This is exhausting. I'm not sure I can make it. And I did hyperbarics as well as probably much of what you did, many supplements, off-label medications during COVID. And then I stopped because COVID was over, but this fatigue lingered. And then I got back in the hyperbaric machine. And granted, I did not have long hauls, but within 5 sessions. And normally when I do hyperbarics, I don't notice a thing. I get in because I know it helps me with my autoimmunity, but I really don't notice anything. And it was literally one session. I was like, wow, wait a minute. And then I did 2, then I did 3. And after 5, I was completely gone. And at least I've recommended that to folks with just fatigue after COVID and have anecdotally gotten back from them the same thing.
Yeah, I think that the people have that experience when they're kind of like you were, they have some lingering fatigue after COVID, but it's sort of resolving slowly. The long haulers get really stuck in like almost in an imprint of this dysfunction. And I have lots of long haul patients, obviously, and I also talk to a lot of colleagues that have a lot of long haul patients. And my wife is very plugged into all the social networking groups and all of that. And so I have a good idea kind of what works and what doesn't work. And One of the hallmarks of long haul COVID is the same thing that works in one person doesn't work in everybody.
Of course. And, you know, couldn't be that simple, could it?
And hyperbaric, even people have done pretty intensive sessions of hyperbaric and rounds and protocols. They generally think that they feel better and functionally more energy, but it's not cure. It kind of makes all the way. Mm-hmm. I wish it did.
Yeah. Well, back to predisposing factors, you mentioned particularly extreme athletes. I'm sure there are people who don't fit into that category that also have it.
Absolutely.
Have you seen anything between those that were vaccinated and those that were not vaccinated? Have you seen, is there any research on that of long haul? Because I know at one point the CDC was recommending if you have long haul, go get vaccinated, that it could help with your long haul. So.
Yeah, I remember when that was all happening. That didn't turn out to work.
Really?
Some people, and this is from me kind of being plugged into all of these social media networks of thousands of long haulers, okay, chatting about this and talking about this. So it's not a controlled scientific experiment, right? But you're getting an idea from large numbers of people. Some people ran right out and did the vaccination. And I would say, more people actually got worse and exacerbated than got better. The ones that got better, I don't know if they really got better or if it was a placebo type of effect. I really don't know. But it wasn't like universally changing of the condition either direction. Some got a little better, some got a little worse. Most didn't change. But, and there's no real well-controlled studies that I'm aware of looking at how many people got, what was your propensity to get long haul when you're exposed to COVID, if you're vaccinated or not. And I think part of what makes that hard is the largest pool of people that have significant, really sticky long haul syndrome actually had COVID before there even was viable vaccines around.
Oh, right.
So
yeah,
the disorder, kind of the virus itself, mutated to be less likely to cause COVID. So if they looked and said people who had vaccination are less likely to get COVID, it may very well be that the virus wasn't as likely to cause long haul at that point, even if they were vaccinated.
Right.
There are certainly people who we know have developed a variant of long haul syndrome from getting vaccinated. They never had acute COVID and they never had symptoms. They got vaccinated and then had long haul. Now, that wasn't very common or very prevalent. And the variant of long haul that they tend to get from just from vaccination doesn't seem to be as severe as people who got it from the original virus. But it's definitely observed. And there is even some data showing that you can tell the difference, let's say, between long haul created by the SARS-CoV-2 virus versus long haul created from the vaccine based on the metabolomics, particularly the cytokine differentials. Mm-hmm. There's different cytokine signatures that are present. They're both dysfunctional, but they're dysfunctionally in slightly different ways.
Got it. Yeah, I was going to ask about the vaccine. There were reports of long haul. I mean, certainly there have been reports of all kinds of things, but
right.
If there was of long haul. So
yes, for sure.
Anyone that is, it's wintertime, there does seem to be an upsurge of COVID right now. Is there anything that you have learned that people could do before getting COVID to potentially prevent long haul? Or if someone is actively suffering with COVID right now, that they could do to potentially ward off getting long haul?
Well, yes. First of all, the things that we knew long before COVID and that a lot of other people discovered once COVID came around, including a lot of healthcare providers, even in functional and integrative medicine, when we started throwing all this data at them that had been out there forever and influenza viruses and coronaviruses and all that. A lot of things that people know to take for immune health, make sure your vitamin D status is optimized. The strongest predictor for a negative outcome and death in acute COVID was your vitamin D level going into exposure, which is amazing. It still just amazes me that data is so strong on that. So making sure you have good vitamin D status, but just routinely taking things like robust amounts of vitamin C and bioflavonoids and getting enough zinc. And a lot of people during the winter, particularly in the Northeast, in these colder areas, the Midwest and all, where you're getting viruses, particularly running through the schools, if you have young children, there's a lot of different good quality immune formulas out there that may have some immune enhancing botanicals or mushroom fractions, things that increase natural killer cells and things like that. And of course, if you get COVID or you're exposed to anybody, let's say you know you had an exposure to someone who turned out, all of a sudden now they say I'm testing positive for COVID, or someone in the house has COVID, you know, you certainly want to double down on all those things. I have to say, looking at all of the data and looking at the Frontline Physicians Consortium and all of that, I have a stock of ivermectin in my house and we take it. If we're exposed at all, we think we're exposed, if we're going to travel, I'm going to get on an airplane, especially if I'm going overseas. And certainly if anyone around us gets sick, we use ivermectin at the right levels for our body weight. And there's different levels for prevention. There's different levels for post-exposure, but not acutely ill. And there's different levels that you would take if you actually had COVID. And you can find all of that online on the Frontline Physicians protocols.
And what do you usually, if you feel like if you're just getting on a plane, do you just take one dose?
Well, I take all the immune stuff
I
talked about. Then I take a dose before I get on the plane. And then there's a dose I take. It's like a two dosing. It's a dose before you get on the plane and kind of a dose the next.
Okay. I usually just do one before I get on the plane.
That's fine. It's a lot better than nothing.
Oh, no, of course. Yeah. I mean, I took it very regularly for the, you know, almost 3 years. And now I really only take it. I mean, probably my biggest exposure is just travel. So I take it on the plane and then, or if I am in some kind of, I mean, I don't ever do anything. I have a small child, so I'm never out at night. But
right.
We went to Disney World, but that was all outside. But certainly if I'm in an indoor environment with a lot of people. But
yeah, and that was a whole just unfortunate thing. I don't want to burn too much time on it. But they didn't come up with ivermectin just by throwing darts at a dartboard. I mean, they did in silico research on the exact mechanism and proteomics and targets and things like that. And the first thing they do when an infectious outbreak kind of hits and they don't really have a direct agent to treat it is they go into what they already know and all this in silico research and all these molecular targets. And they look at in the computers now with AI, the structure of the drug and the structure, and they look at the genome of the virus, and it's very, very sophisticated. And they hit on these conventionally used as anti-parasitics. They're broadly antimicrobial. They're not just anti-parasitic. In older drugs, physicians know how to use them. They know how to use them safely. Do they have some side effects if you use them wrong? In some individuals, yes, but virtually every drug does. But they didn't just stumble upon ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. They were picked because of actual research looking at they were probable to work from what they've known with coronaviruses all along. And lo and behold, they did. But it seemed that there were other interests that really wanted to make sure that the hero, if there was one, was a brand new drug that's still on IP that ends in the name Vir or involved a vaccination. And I didn't care what worked. I just wanted things to work. Don't really have a bias in that regard, but the way that these agents that were safe and very cheap, perfect agent to treat a pandemic is a drug that's already there. You know how it works. You know how to deal with the side effects. You know how to prescribe it. It's pennies per dose, right? And it's effective.
Well, isn't that what they gave out? And they gave that out in India. It's what the entire country took, along with Zinc.
Well, you know, that's one of the most ubiquitously just given out without even clinical management or testing drug on the planet, because it treats river blindness and all these parasites all in the underdeveloped world. And it was always on the World Health Organization, all these sites, as one of the safest drugs. And all of a sudden, it became this dangerous drug that was a horse dewormer. It wasn't a horse dewormer. It was a human antimicrobial that was happened to then be started to be used veterinary medicine, like just about every other drug. It's just craziness.
Yeah. I mean, it's because there wasn't money to be made there, right?
I guess. Above my pay grade, but it's pretty sad.
Yes. Well, and then the doctors that are, I don't know if they still are, but I certainly heard some stories 6 months to a year ago of certain doctors getting, frankly, persecuted and turned into the board for prescribing it to people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Luckily, that's pretty much changed and FDA's changed their stance on it and CDC. But after the fact, without much fanfare, oops, sorry, we didn't really mean that.
Right.
Unfortunately, the whole experience just eroded a lot of physicians and certainly the general public's sort of trust in public health authorities and what they say. And that's the saddest thing of all, probably besides the death.
The deaths, yes. No, I mean, the deaths and the polarization. I mean, even with my own family, huge polarization of...
That was tough too.
Yeah. Very tough. Very tough. And bullying online and other things.
Really stuff I never thought we'd see, but lived through it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have talked about predisposition. We've talked about things that you can do if you have COVID actively or to prevent. And so what are you seeing? We briefly touched on it with your wife's case, but what are you seeing as possible treatments?
It's a multi-pronged approach. There's things we use that would be in the drug realm, right? Most of it off-label use because there's no approved drug as of right now for long-haul COVID. And there's things we use sort of in the nutraceutical or the nutritional supplement realm. And then there are sort of other types of therapies that we use. Some of them would be considered more regenerative type of therapies I can talk about. And then there's sort of lifestyle stuff. So when it comes down to sort of drug land, there's various things that have been thrown at it, various protocols. One of the most popular one that went around for a while, and anyone who has long haul probably has heard of this. Some people call it the Stanford protocol. It was really advocated by a doc who did a lot of work in viruses in general, and at once been at Stanford, but then he did a lot of work in long haul as well. But it was sort of a combination of using a low dose statin, which are the cholesterol lowering drugs, but at a pretty low dose, an older statin, actually Prevostatin at about 10 milligrams, plus combined it with an antiviral drug known as Maraviroc or Selzentry is the other name of the drug. And it's a drug actually used in HIV cocktail. It's a CCL5 inhibitor. And they noticed that CCL5 or Rantes is a cytokine that pops on cytokine testing in long-haul patients. So they knew that there was a drug from HIV experience that pushes down the pathway. So they tried that and they used the statin not to lower cholesterol, but statins have the ability to modify really deep tissue microinflammation. And they act on a pathway in the small blood vessels along the endothelium called the fractaline pathway. So it was a very rational, like mechanistically understood reason why they use these two agents. And some people, we were very hopeful about it early on. Some people seem to say they got better. In the end, it was not transformative. Most people didn't. If they did get better, it didn't seem like the positive results stayed. Like they became sort of refractive to whatever benefit they got. A lot of people use low-dose naltrexone to some success. There's even off-label use of some antidepressants, which was actually used in acute COVID as well for a while, known as fluvoxamine or Luvox. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case with all of the SSRIs, antidepressants. It's not a class effect. It's unique to that one because it's a sigma-1 modulator. So it also works on very, very deep tissue inflammation. And there's at least some theories that a lot of the hypervigilance, the anxiety, the depression, even the heightened perception of pain, like you see in fibromyalgia, even some of the immune dysfunction may be because of inflammation at very deep brain centers and microglial inflammation. And these agents can beat that down a little bit. Treating more of the POTS, which could be really some of the symptoms that make the patients most miserable. The tachycardia, the standing up and being faint, the Raynaud's. With the tachycardia, sometimes we have to use a beta blocker.
Yeah, I mean, my POTS patients when I was in clinic, I mean, they were some of the hardest patients in general.
Exactly.
So.
And it's like that plus a police other symptoms. Right. The weird pain around the chest wall. I mean, we've used various things, including even older drugs like colchicine seems to bite down the pain a little bit. Antihistamines can be used like hydroxyzine. Valacyclovir can seem to help some people, particularly if they get a secondary bloom of their Epstein-Barr virus. So one thing that long haul can do is maybe the insult was initially the SARS-CoV-2 and the spike protein, and it changed their immune response, but it created an opportunistic environment for secondary stealth infections to bloom. Epstein-Barr virus, cytomegalovirus, herpes viruses, Lyme, mm-hmm. co-infections, Borrelia, all of that. So sometimes
and then
you're
that,
managing that.
And then that kicks up the autoimmunity potential for people.
It goes round and round. There's actually been some research into biologics and response modifiers that are used in autoimmune disease. In long haul, jury's still out on that. There was actually a neurologist for a while here in Florida actually using Enbrel or Intercept injected a paraspinal injection of Enbrel. And it seemed to really calm down these long haulers. And you were kind of excited about it. It was like a pre-publication release of a clinical trial. And then it all kind of shut down. So I don't know what happened, if there was some pressure that came to Barry, just stopped doing it and just stopped really researching it.
That's a shame.
There's been some people publishing more mechanistic, hypothetical, no real outcome research yet on PD-1 checkpoint inhibitors that are used in cancer in long haul syndrome, which is really interesting. But those drugs are, that's like Keytruda, Opdivo, Libtayo. Those are hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. It's about like, I think now it's $150 to $2,000 a year to be on that therapy if you don't have insurance. And insurance is not going to cover it for long haul syndrome. Right. So it's really not viable, right? But there are a lot of natural PD-1 checkpoint inhibitors, which we use in the nutraceutical realm for this, including a lot of the things even that we mentioned before, long haul COVID, a lot of polyphenols, bioflavonoids. So the resveratrol, quercetin, luteolin, curcumin, cordyceps, mushrooms, melatonin is a good immune modulator. We throw that at it. But we also use things that affect the vascular system. This is really a vascular biology issue. It's a vascular biologist's nightmare, guess, or dream if they want to research it. But things that increase NO or nitric oxide. So whether it's things like your beetroot or arginines or whatever, now they have some things that recycle arginine through the mouth oral microbiome with gums and gummies and things which can be helpful. And things that help with the endothelial layer in the arteries. So there's things like arteriosols and things that can be very helpful.
Are you using any of the proteolytic enzymes? Like nanokinase?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. That's definitely a big part of, because there is a lot of theories on different microclotting type of phenomena in long haul. So definitely we use nanokinase quite a bit. Serrapeptidase, arteriosol, that's kind of seaweed extract, has some anti-platelet and anti-aggregation benefits to it. And the nitric oxide modulators can do that to some degree. We definitely throw a lot of mitochondrial stuff at it. So CoQ10 is great in the ubiquinol form, but it doesn't really get in the mitochondria very well at the dosages that most people use, 100, 200 milligrams a couple times a day. Most studies show you got to IV it up in the multigram levels to appreciably change mitochondrial CoQ10 levels and ATP production. So we often will go at it more to try to increase endogenous CoQ10 production by giving a smaller molecule that can get in the mitochondria called GG or geraniol. It's a very it's newer on the scene in the nutraceutical space, but also NAD sort of precursors or modulators, whether it's nicotinamide riboside, NMN, you can make a case for all of them. Ribose, I mean, all the things that we've used for a long time for energetics, even L-carnitine to try to get more energy out of fatty acids.
What about glutathione?
Glutathione for sure. Definitely glutathione and N-acetylcysteine. That's a go-to acute chronic COVID, anything. We use it orally and we actually will nebulize it, particularly if there's any kind of persistent lung issues or if there's any kind of ongoing mild even dyspnea. Sometimes we've actually nebulized glutathione along with there's a liquid form out of pyloric acid or monolaurin, which is an antiviral, which can be helpful in any kind of upper respiratory infection, but just oral monolaurin and other antivirals like mushroom fractions and things can really help in some of the patients. But it's still not broadly agreed on what's fueling the fire in these patients. Is there any kind of hidden tissue reservoirs of viably replicating virus? Or is it just spike protein that is still around in the body tissues, creating this constant immune stimulus? Is it, did the virus or even the vaccine reprogram the cells to make a variant of spike protein, which is fueling the immune response? Or is it just the initial insult dysregulated the cytokine and the immune response and the signature of how the immune system is behaving in some people, and it's stuck for some reason? It's like an imprinted thing. We don't really know. I mean, honestly.
And from a dietary and lifestyle standpoint? I'm obviously assuming a low inflammatory diet.
Yeah, just a really clean, good, fresh diet, like a Mediterranean diet. A lot of people do better off of antigenic foods that have a high propensity to not agree with the human immune response, like gluten-containing grains, dairy, and things. That it really depends on the patient on how aggressive they want to get. We'll test it. We'll try it with them. And I advocate for it, but it's some people will do it and some people won't. The other thing that we do is really trying to make the microbiome in good shape and intact, treat any barrier integrity of the gut. We use a lot of fermented products and things like that in their diet for that reason. And then the other thing is trying to calm down the central nervous system. And that takes many forms. Some of them are directly therapeutic, like we use those vagal nerve stimulators, mm-hmm. like gamma cord devices. You can even use a TENS unit with a pad on a clip on your tragus of your left ear and on the back of your deltoid and just run a TENS unit for a while every day. That can help. Gargling, singing, all these different vagal nerve exercises, which people can just look on YouTube and get a lot of good information on these days. But they really have to calm their central nervous system. So whatever resonates with them, mindfulness of some type. So whether it's meditation, whether it's relaxing, stretching kind of yoga, I think getting the body to move through all the planes of motion, like in a yoga, tai chi kind of practice, is a good thing to do. And there's something that is very effective with trying to help people get to sleep, because they're typical hypervigilance patients, like you see in all these post-viral syndromes. They get anxiety and their mind is racing and they can't go to sleep. And then once they get to sleep, they don't stay asleep often. But even if they do sleep, if you do put Aura rings on or sleep lab them, they don't really get into delta deep wave restorative sleep. So they wake up unrefreshed. So you can trick that a little bit with things like lysine and time release melatonin and all these different things. Some peptides can be useful there. But there's something called binaural beats, which come out of more mindfulness yoga practice.
I love binaural beats. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's specific frequencies for getting to sleep. There's specific frequencies for just calming the central nervous system's response. So like for hypervigilance, PTSD, binaural beats. So getting really good quality headphones and doing binaural beats can be helpful. I've had patients do kind of these brain retraining programs, right? That are
I was going to ask usually about neurofeedback.
Like functional neurofeedback. Alex Howard in the UK has a good program. There's a Gupta program. There's a lot of programs out there now that are pretty good at doing that, and they help a lot of people. And then the last thing, we use regenerative therapies. And unfortunately, many of these are hard to get now. Many of them may be going away and being even harder to get. But my wife, for instance, has gotten really good benefit from therapeutic peptides, including a mitochondrial peptide known as MOTC, which is injectable, and another immune modulating peptide known as thymusin alpha 1. But these are getting harder to get because of regulatory action. And there's some proposed stiffer regulatory action, I think, coming up next month, which may make it almost impossible to get them. And she's actually gotten umbilical stem cell infusion on multiple occasions with some exosome growth factors. And we really think that made a big difference. Tends to lift her out of long haul kind of pattern. It keeps her better for a while, but it decays. About every 6 months, we have to get these infusions and she stays better. But it's a constant maintenance.
If someone's looking to do peptides, is there a website that you think is really reputable, or just working with a physician?
You got to find a doc who really knows peptides and is trained in them. There's really good courses in peptides that A4M offers and things like that. And I think there's something, I think it's called the American Peptide Society. They can look that up online. And that tends to be where all these really knowledgeable integrative docs who do peptides and regenerative therapies kind of congregate. And there might be even a referral sort of network on there that can find one closest to them. There's a lot of junk peptides out there too that people can buy orally on Amazon and stuff, that just the vast majority of functional peptides that really work do not survive oral delivery, especially these synthetic peptides. So they usually are injected or infused. There are exceptions to what I just said, but by and large, most of the stuff you can buy just kind of direct on Amazon or anything right now or not. I move the dial like these injected peptides.
Yeah, no, I went to a website, but maybe it's because I am a physician that I was able to get them. There was a period when I was doing a couple of peptides for a chronic hip condition, and I was purchasing them myself and injecting them myself. But
there are certain ones that you can still get and other ones that have gotten very hard to get because the FDA has looked at these things kind of one by one and sometimes in functional blocks and decide, oh, well, this is really an unapproved drug. Then go through IND, you know, and I think there's pressure from pharma, frankly, saying, hey, because they work almost like with a drug-like effect on targets. So, but they're small little molecules. So I think there's pressure just from a regulatory standpoint to get them out of the scene and economical turf protection kind of thing, probably. But some of them really, really do work. And they seem to go heaviest at the immune modulating ones because they were being used in COVID and they were very sensitive. And they also start encroaching on, they're being used in autoimmunity a lot. So maybe they're encroaching on the TERP biologics response modifiers. And if anyone's listening, that's all just conjecture because it's above my pay grade.
Right. I don't know. So we talked about pharmaceutical drugs. We talked about nutraceuticals. We talked about neurologic calming the nervous system down through vagus nerve and neurofeedback, biurnal beats. We talked diet. Anything else? We talked hyperbarics. Is there anything else? A sauna, cold plunge, any cryotherapy, anything else that you've seen better, worse?
I think all of those things are worth trying and seeing how they work for you and how you feel. I don't think those things are panaceas and universally curative, but it's not just about that. It's about making you as an individual feel better and have more functionality. And if those things help you, then great, do them. And because there's rational reasons why they may change metabolism or be good for you, whether you had long-haul COVID or not. A lot of people seem to say they do good with blood ozone, but not everybody does.
What about rectal ozone?
I don't know. I haven't really tried that or heard of many people who've used it with long-haul. It's interesting thing to know. But yeah, a lot of people are going overseas for other types of treatments to get them, including like levels of plasma exchange and apheresis, things like that, where they really remove a lot of blood plasma and elements, trying to pull out all these antibodies to spike protein and even accumulated toxins, pesticides and metals and everything else, like kind of like, let's clean the blood and give you a fresh start kind of thing.
You know, but Hasse does that exchange. Now.
Yeah.
Hasse's doing, David Hasse.
Yeah, there's some docs.
I don't know that he's doing it for long haul. He was doing it for autoimmunity. Right. So I don't know if he's tried it with long haul or
and
not.
And there's different variants of that kind of therapy. From what I understand, far from an expert, there's some levels of therapies like that that you can do in the United States. And there's others that can't that they're doing like in Germany, Central America, and South America. So I don't know where those lines are drawn on what you can viably do in the U.S. and not. The U.S. is much more restrictive on various regenerative therapies, including stem cell options versus some other countries. So that's why some people have to travel overseas if they want certain variants of regenerative therapies.
Yeah. What do you see on the horizon? Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you see could be coming down the pike for folks with long haul?
Yeah, the one thing I didn't mention, capstoning this, is just what's the whole idea of pacing. These patients have a hard time pacing because when they start to feel better, they just, human nature, they want to go out and do what they miss doing. So they overdo it, right? And they crash and burn themselves. So there's lots of good stuff out there.
Well, they're already the overachievers, right? If they're elite athletes and the high energy people.
Not all of them, but a lot of them. But they have to get their mindset different in pacing. I'm not metabolically the same as I was. As far as the horizon, there is a lot of work being done, I think, by various private and publicly funded entities and in academic medicine to try to get a handle on long-haul COVID and treat it in some way that really moves the dial more universally. And I'm hopeful that if they do, any of them are successful, that it doesn't only provide a significant benefit to long-haul COVID sufferers, but I'm really hopeful that it will also help all those people that have been labeled with chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and all these other post-viral syndrome, because I think there's a connection to all of it. And if they can climb really upstream and get to something in the dysfunction that really alters that whole cascade, I'm hopeful that can help, you know, millions of people.
Absolutely. Well, I always like to end the podcast with three things that you can recommend to our listeners to take back their health. You can have that be broad, or if you want to have it be for those with long haul, however you choose to see the question.
Oh, well, I have more than three, but I'll stick it to three. I think the biggest one is figure out how and what it takes for you to sleep well. If you have chronic insomnia and you don't get restorative sleep and you wear any kind of monitoring device and you don't get into deep stage three delta wave sleep, there's find someone who can help you figure out how you can sleep better. Because if you're not sleeping good and getting restoration when you sleep, it's going to be almost impossible to be healthy. Number two is just eat good food. I don't care. I'm not really strict on which diet and not like that, but it's got to be real, whole, fresh food. One of my nutrition mentors told me 35 years ago, it's simple. Just look at your plate when you're about to eat and ask yourself, could you have gotten the food in the form you're eating it essentially 100 years ago? Is it real food or is it junk and fake food? If you eat junk, fake food, you're going to have junk, fake metabolism. It's going to work. And the other thing is sort of gratitude and love. Just be grateful for life and everything you got, the good stuff, the bad stuff, the trials and the tribulations, and the people around you who love you and you love. Just think about it every day, because it's easy to overlook and you don't realize it until it's gone.
Absolutely. Well, I'm grateful for you. And
likewise.
Yes, feeling like we need to get back to our journal club.
I know, so, yeah, we should.
I'll send out an email.
Okay.
I will do it. I miss you guys.
Because you need another thing to manage.
Yeah, I need another thing to manage. But it's so interesting, you know, that now that I'm out of clinical practice, I don't see all of this as much. And it's interesting. And I, you know, still have the desire to help people however I can. So
absolutely.
I do appreciate you being on, and love to you and your family. And if there's anything that I can do to help you guys, please let me know. I'm sorry you were dealing with this and I didn't know about it.
Yeah, that's all right.
Well, I'm here if I can do anything.
Okay, thank you, Amy.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate having you on. Oh, and finally, how can people find you?
Oh, I just, the easiest way to generally find me and figure out about me is just go to my main website, which is drdavidbrady.com, drdavidbrady.com. If you're mainly interested in fibromyalgia and the book and all that, you can go to fibrofix.com, F-I-B-R-O-F-I-X.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I want to thank this week's guests for sharing their time and knowledge, and thank you for listening. To read the full show notes for each episode, which include a summary, timestamp, quotes, and any resources mentioned, please visit amymyersmd.com/podcast. Lastly, if you've enjoyed this episode, I'd love if you would leave a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify, and we'll select a few to read out loud in a future episode. Tune in next week to hear from another inspiring guest as we help you take back your health.